dreamed that you would live. But Godshawk took you away with him to his laboratories at Nonsuch House, and although I was too weak to go and see you there, he sent word to me by a servant every day. Every day I woke up fearing that they would tell me you were dead, but every day they said, "She's still alive, she's still alive, your father is doing all he can, medical machines not seen since ancient days." And then, in early summer, when the blossom was still on the trees, he brought you home to me. You were in your little basket. Your eyes had changed, two different colours. He said it was a side effect of the surgery he had performed, and I did not complain. I was just so happy to see you, and so grateful to Godshawk for having saved you. But we had so little time together, Fever. There were riots in the city, and the mercenaries whom Godshawk had hired to protect us betrayed us and joined with the rioters instead. You and I were still living at the Barbican, and so were other Scriven, friends of Godshawk, sheltering from the riots. One morning he had us all gather in the basement and showed us the secret passage to Nonsuch House. We begged him to come with us, but he refused. He said he would stay and seal up the tunnel entrance, then organize a last stand against the Skinners. "They can't kill me," he said, as we set off along the tunnel. "Just keep that baby safe, daughter." That night, from the windows of Nonsuch House, we heard their horrid cheering drifting across the marshes, as if the whole of London was celebrating, and we knew that Godshawk was dead. We stayed there, hidden, for nearly 2 weeks. At first we felt sure that some Scriven nobleman would have survived the riots, that they'd retake London and come to rescue us. But slowly we realized we were alone. There was not much to eat. The others squabbled. Some said I should not keep you, Fever, that it was wrong to let a half-human hybrid eat food real Scriven needed. When they were not arguing and blaming one another and inventing hopeless schemes to win the city back, the men went out and cut the causeway to make sure no looters reached us. Though there was enough loot on Ludgate Hill to keep the commons busy for a long time. At the end of the second week the Skinners came for us. My companions shot at them from the gardens, and thought they'd killed them all. How they jeered and laughed, flinging stones at the bodies afloat in the lagoon. But one had survived, and that night he came to the house. As the panic grew, I took you from your basket and ran and hid. I snuggled down with you on the floor of a cupboard in one of the bedrooms, and listened to the men as they shouted to one another, asking where the Skinner was, and the clang of his spring gun as he appeared out of the shadows to shoot them down one by one, and the screams. Gradually the house grew quiet, a horrible silence. I whispered lullabies to you, and your little hands pulled at my nose and ears, and you made a sound. Not crying, just a little baby gurgle. And the Skinner heard you. I could sense him, padding toward us through the house. I put my hand over your face, but I dared not hold it too tight for fear I'd smother you. And you were happy, Fever, snuggled up with me there in that place full of soft things. You started laughing, you made trilling sounds and little wicked chuckles. And then, bang, a hole appeared in the cupboard door, just in the place where my head would have been if I'd been standing up. Light was coming in. The force of the shot made the door swing open. I tried to stop it. I clawed at the wood, but my fingers couldn't find a purchase on it. The door swung wide open, and there outside it stood the Skinner, with his long black coat and his black hat and his pale eyes and his spring gun. I held you so tight, Fever. You sensed, I think, the danger we were in, or else his first shot had shocked you quiet. Quiet you were, anyway. I watched him, waiting for him to raise that gun. And I waited. And after a while he let out a long breath and a cough. He'd been sunk in the marsh all day. And he put the gun away. "Well," he said, looking around the room as if I weren't there, "I suppose I'd better burn this place. It'll take me 10 minutes, I reckon, to set the fire." And he turned and went out of the room. For one whole minute I just sat there. Then I jumped up and rummaged in the cupboard for an outdoor coat and found some boots down on the floor. I'd been wondering what they were, digging into my bottom all the time that we'd been hiding there. I pulled on the boots and wrapped that cloak around us both, and I was off, down the hill and out across the marshes. And after 10 minutes I looked back, and there was fire in all the windows of Nonsuch House. When morning came, I struck out for a dig I knew, owned by a man named Unthank, who had worked for my father sometimes. He welcomed me, but he said he couldn't hide me long. I decided to go north and seek shelter among the nomad empires. But I knew I couldn't take you with me. You were too small for such a journey. And besides, what if my Skinner had regretted his mercifulness and told his friends of me, What if the Skinner's guilds and the new guards on the moatway were all looking out for a woman with a baby girl? There was only one thing to do, Fever dear. I left you there with Unthank, and I told him to call Dr. Crumb there on some pretense. Dr. Crumb is a good man, I told him. He'll take care of the child. And he did, didn't he, Fever Crumb? Because look at you. You're a young woman, nearly. And I've no doubt you're just as sweet and clever as your father. Chapter 31 Hidden Treasures. Mother, said Fever, very quietly and self-consciously, because it was the first time she'd ever used the word. What did Godshawk do to me? Wavy's dark eyes darkened further. She glanced away. What do you mean? I remember things. Things that happened to him, not to me. There was a little silence. They could hear people moving around somewhere below them in the fortress's engine rooms, the clangs and clatter of refueling. Nicola Quercus stirred and shifted, over by the chamber door. "What does the girl mean?" he asked. "You never told me anything of this." "Godshawk did something to me, didn't he?" Fever prompted. "He performed some operation on my brain to give me his memories." "Oh, Fever," said Wavy, wondering.
"Is this true?" asked Quercus, coming nearer. "She has the old man's knowledge in her, his thoughts."
Wavy looked quickly at him, then back to Fever. "It might be. It is possible."
"And you were keeping this secret to yourself, perhaps, Snow Leopard?"
"I did not know," said Wavy. "At least I could not be certain. I guessed that he had placed some engine in her head. There was that scar still fresh when she came back to me, but I did not know what its purpose was." She pursed her lips, shook her head, looked down, and looked up at Fever. She reached out to fondle the faint, scratchy stubble of the girl's regrowing hair. She said, "Godshawk spent decades studying the brains of stalkers. He made expeditions to the uttermost north, where the old stalker builders lived in the years after the downsizing. He traded with the natives there for certain artifacts, rare stalker brains of strange design, taken from temples on the high ice, things made in the long ago by people for whom stalkers were much more than the mere fighting machines we know today, machines which could capture and curate memories, even the memories of the dead. For years, Godshawk and his friend Unthank studied them back at Nonesuch House. Godshawk did not want to die, you see, and he was convinced that he did not have to. He hoped to copy his consciousness into one of those ancient brains and install it in a new body when his old one failed. He talked of doing the same with all the Skriven. Then we truly will be homo superior, he used to say. Immortal, unperishing. Imagine the things a man might do if he had eternity to do them in, not just our present measly span of years." "But it didn't work, did it?" Fever asked. Another shrug, a shy, wry smile. "I helped him to imprint his mind onto the brains. That worked, as far as he could tell. But when he tried to put those brains in new bodies, something always went wrong. He placed them in dead men, and they remembered nothing, just like ordinary stalkers. He put them into living men, slaves and Skinner prisoners, and they simply died. I thought he had given up, moved on to other projects."
"But then," said Fever, "he put one into me."
Wavy nodded. The tears that had been forming in her eyes spilled out and trickled down her face. "And you did not die. A young body, perhaps that was what it required. A newborn body, where the stalker brain would have plenty of time to bed in before it was activated by the tides of adolescence."
"He told you that," said Fever, actually ducking to avoid a memory Wavy's words called up of Godshawk's own adolescence and a girl he'd kissed at Rag Fair on a snowy afternoon.
"I'm guessing," said Wavy. "It might have been simple desperation that made him try it. The Skinner's guilds had grown horribly strong by the time you were born, and he knew his days were numbered. You were on the brink of death anyway, poor little thing. What had he to lose by putting the device in your head? He would have injected you at the same time with microscopic machines that he harvested from the bodies of ancient stalkers. They would have helped to repair the damage to your brain and stop infections forming. At least, that was his belief. They never worked in his other subjects. But here you are, alive."
"Here I am," said Fever, numbly. "But was she? Was this her, or was it Auric Godshawk?"
She reached behind her head and let her fingers trace the faint, rippled line of the scar, the zipper where Godshawk had opened her skull and slipped in his machine.
the shape of a walnut, the size of an almond, the spring from which all those unfamiliar memories flowed. More washed over her now, memories of Wavy mostly, pleasant memories, but still upsetting because she wanted to get used to the idea that this woman was her mother, but she kept seeing her as someone younger than herself, a little girl, a favourite daughter, a workroom protégé. She had no memories, thankfully, of the experiments Godsawk must have done, the operations he had carried out on both the living and the dead in an attempt to preserve his selfish self. She supposed his consciousness had been crammed into the stalker brain at a time before those experiments were done. She was glad of that, for she could already sense things surfacing that made her feel giddy with disgust. The fights at Pickle the Eel Circus, and Godsawk's excitement as he sat watching in the royal enclosure. His satisfaction as he viewed the progress of his huge portrait head, ignoring what Fever could not ignore, the suffering of the slave gangs who were constructing it. She began to shudder, and suddenly hot tears were running down her face, and Wavy was reaching out to hold her, but she pulled away. Wavy said, "Poor Fever. All these years you've been hidden in Godsawk's head, and now you find out that he's been hiding in yours." Fever sniffled and choked and swallowed salty snot. She hadn't cried since she was tiny. It made her feel irrational and ashamed. "Can you get it out of me?" she whispered, clutching her head, battered by the storms of alien memories. "Can you turn it off?" "I don't think so," said Wavy. "We cannot," said Quercus very firmly, sounding like a soldier for the first time. Fever saw his shiny boots approach across the oak-planked deck. "If this is true, Miss Crumb, then we need the knowledge that you carry. My gods! All Godsawk's genius at our disposal. You are a greater treasure than any in that vault." Fever looked sharply at him. "Oh yes, Miss Crumb. We know about the vault."
"From Dr. Staling?" she asked.
The northerner shook his head. "I have not told Staling of it. We could not risk having your order of engineers helping themselves to its contents. No, it was your mother who told me of it, many years ago. Back then, we had no reason to believe it still existed. We assumed that it had been looted or destroyed during your Skinner's riots. Then one of my agents, the woman you know as Mistress Gloomstove, became aware of Master Solent's activities. That is what convinced me to advance on London." Fever blinked. It felt strange having to recast Mistress Gloomstove as a movement spy, but stranger things had happened that day. She said, "What's in the vault, anyway?" Wavy did not answer her, but looked instead at Nicola Quercus. "More stalker stuff," Fever prompted. "More things like this one inside me." "No, no," said Wavy. "Godsawk had given up that project long before you were born. He was working on something else. That statue he began to build was just a cover, an excuse to start constructing great factory sheds and importing tons of steel and raw materials. He was afraid that if he told people what he was really planning, they would think it madness."
"What, madder than a mile-high statue of himself?" asked Fever.
Wavy ignored her, smiling shyly toward Quercus. "After I left you at Unthank's Dig, Fever, I wandered for years, all through the Minarchies and up into the Nomad Empires, earning my living as a travelling technomancer. I never spoke to anyone of what I was and who my father had been. I never hoped to return to London. But when I came aboard this castle and met Quercus, I saw at once that here was a man who could appreciate Godsawk's vision. I told him about the vault and what it contained, and he decided that the movement must have it." Again her mother looked at Quercus, and Fever realized that she was waiting for him to decide whether they should share the secret of the vault with Fever.
"What is it?" she said.
She thought of those loose pencil sketches of cogs and heat exchangers in the notebook on Kit Solent's library table, and dim memories of imaginary machines woke and whirred in her mind, but there was nothing that she could make sense of.
"What was Godsawk working on? What is in the vault?"
Behind her, softly, Nicola Quercus said, "The future."
Chapter 32. Technomancy. Down on the underdecks of the fortress, preparations were underway for the final assault on London. The technomancers who guarded the mysteries of its engines went about their work, opening the fuel cocks, oiling the pistons, coaxing the aged machinery into noisy motion, chanting prayers and incantations to keep it running. And at the same time, gangs of slaves from the barrack barges were marched aboard the fortress to take their places in the giant wooden drums that flanked the engine rooms. When 40 men were shackled in each drum, they too became engines of a kind.
The energy they generated as they tramped endlessly along the rolling inner surface of their treadmills was transferred by means of cogs and camshafts to the drive wheels. Slowly, as the lower decks filled with the smells of engine fumes and slave sweat, the fortress began to move. Barrel-shaped wheels, studded to grip the snows of the northern frost barrens, coped easily with the mud and scrub of Hampster's Heath. By the light of the rising moon, it pushed its blunt prow through the orbital moatway, and from its funnels came a shrill, triumphant woot, as with its escort of armoured barges spread out like wings on either side of it, it began to roll toward the lights of London. They let Fever have a little narrow cabin, and she lay down on the cot in the corner of it and tried to sleep. But how could she sleep, with the whole place shuddering and her mind a stew of someone else's memories? There seemed to be more of them every minute, and she was starting to be afraid that if they kept multiplying, there would soon be no room left for her inside her own head. If the decisions she made about the future weren't based on her own experience but on Godshawk's, mightn't she start to behave more and more like him? Perhaps her own personality would fade completely, and she would be nothing but Godshawk's avatar, the evil old man reborn in a new body. She climbed off the cot, which was really more like a padded shelf, space being precious in a traction fortress. She had not bothered to take off her trousers or shirt when she laid down. Quickly she pulled on her boots, and the coat that Wavy Godshawk had brought to replace her own blood-stained, mud-stained one. It was a movement woman's coat, cut long and slender out of red silk, with a deeper red snowflake pattern and a fox fur collar. Part of Fever thought it most irrational, but another part, the Godshawk part, thought she looked the bee's knees as she left the cabin. There was a scent of smoke and metal in the cramped corridors. Movement warriors hurried to and fro, holding on to the handrails on the wall each time the fortress juddered over some obstacle. They stared at Fever as she passed, but none tried to stop or question her. She was the Land Admiral's guest, after all. She took a few wrong turnings, confused by the many passageways and sub-levels, but she found her way at last to the big chamber where she had first met Quercus. He was there again, sitting in his big chair, listening to a report which one of his captains was shouting at him above the steady clangour of the fortress's progress. He had put on a coat of mail over his tunic, and there was steel armour on his neck and forearms. The other people in the chamber were all soldiers, armed and armoured. The women had been banished below. Quercus looked round and saw Fever standing there. "Miss Crumb," he said, "you should not be here." He spoke politely, but in a way that made it plain that he did not expect her to argue. "It may get dangerous as we approach the city. There is trouble in London, and our agents there are no longer sure who is in charge. There may be resistance, and you are too important to risk." He rose from his seat and came closer, looking curiously at Fever's face. "It will be one thing to capture Godshawk's invention, but quite another to make it work and build replicas and do all the thousand things that must be done. If you really have the old man's thoughts inside you, you will be invaluable. It will be like having Godshawk himself there to help us." "You still haven't told me what is in the vault," said Fever. "What has my mother promised you that made it worth bringing your castle all this way?" Quercus laughed. "Look inside yourself, Miss Crumb. Search among the old man's memories." Then he glanced past her and snapped his fingers. "Captain Andringer!" he shouted. A young warrior came hurrying to take Fever by the arm and escort her out of the command chamber. He was polite and respectful, but firm. "No women, no girls, not here, not when we are going into action. It is bad luck." "Is there going to be more fighting?" asked Fever. "We hope not, but your people may have placed some artillery pieces among their northern suburbs. Don't worry. Our big guns can knock out their batteries before they do us any damage. May I help you back to your cabin?" "Where is my mother?" asked Fever, who didn't want to be alone if there was to be a battle. "The Snow Leopard?" He looked wary. "She is at work, in the Resurrectory." "Where's that?" The young man was doubtful. He looked back at the door of the command chamber, as if he was thinking of asking permission from his Land Admiral, but Quercus had a battle to direct. He shrugged and took Fever's arm again. "Come, I'll take you." The Resurrectory was deep in the castle's rumbling innards, down among the engines and the straining slaves. Fever, recalling that her mother was a technomancer, and that the nomads thought of technology as magic or a gift from the gods, imagined that it would be some sort of temple. When her guide showed her in through its heavy doors, she saw at once that she'd been quite wrong. It was a place of science. Science of a sort. The sort of science that felt almost like magic even to an engineer. Stuff that no one understood, but which stubbornly went on working anyway. Electric lamp swung from the centre of the low roof, lighting up a bench where Wavy Godsawk and two red-robed assistants bent over a dead man, turning him patiently and carefully into another stalker for the movement's army. Wavy turned from her work as her daughter came in. She pushed up the brass goggles that she wore and smiled, as if there was no corpse lying on the zinc-topped slab in front of her. But there was, and because it was not yet fully sheathed in its stalker armour, Fever could see that it was the corpse of Kit Soland. She put a hand to her mouth and backed against the door, which the man who led her there had closed behind him as he left. Her engineer upbringing had never been so tested. Her reason told her that Kit Soland was dead, and that it did not matter what happened to his remains. Her instincts all screamed at her that it was wrong, wrong, wrong to strip and mutilate him like that, and fill the hollow of his chest with whatever those weird, gleaming devices were, to fit those flashlights in the craters where his eyes had been. "Fever," said Wavy, pulling off soiled rubber gloves as she came round the work table to greet her daughter. "Are you all right? You look quite pale. Don't be afraid. Quercus has fought ever so many battles and always brings us safely through." Fever could not stop staring at what was left of Kit. Plastic tubes led from his veins, pumping out blood, pumping in chemicals. The robed assistants were busy fitting clumsy-looking metal hands to the armour that encased his arms. His real hands, discarded, stuck out of a soggy basket on the deck, looking pale and stupid and unreal. "Quercus said he would be treated with honour," she said, in a tiny voice. "But this is an honour, Fever, according to the customs of the movement," replied her mother. "Only the best fighters are reborn as stalkers, so that their bodies may go on serving the movement even after their souls have gone to the high halls. It is a privilege extended to very few enemies. Your Master Soland was a brave man, and this is Quercus's way of acknowledging that bravery." She put a comforting arm around Fever's shoulders, but Fever shrugged it off. She hated being touched, and she didn't want comfort. She had done quite well without a mother for 14 years. Why did Wavy think that she suddenly needed so much stroking and hugging? She mastered her feeling of nausea and stepped closer to the horrid table. She saw that the machines that had been packed into Kit's torso were already old, ancient technology recycled down the centuries in stalker after stalker, just as she and Dr. Crumb had recycled the new council's stock of brains and claws and eyes into generations of paperboys. In some ways, she supposed, this was a fitting end for an archaeologist. "I didn't know you did this," she said thinly. "How do you think I managed to become Quercus's technomancer in the first place?" asked Wavy. "I spent so long assisting Godsawk that I can build stalkers in my sleep. Though not for much longer, I fear. Our supplies of stalker brains are running out, and the art of making new ones is long lost. That makes it even grander, in a way, that Quercus has ordered your friend to be resurrected. The new brain in Master Solent's head is the best we have in stock, bought from a snowmad trader who found it high, high up on the northern ice. I think you really impressed him, Fever. Quercus, I mean. I'm sure he likes you. We really must try and do something with your hair." "But will he remember anything?" asked Fever. "Quercus?" "No, Master Solent!" "Nothing," Wavy promised her. "Your friend is dead. This new warrior we are building will not be Master Solent at all, but a stalker. Implacable and undying. What power source keeps all those devices running inside him? How is he fueled?" "No fuel is required." "But that would break the laws of thermodynamics." "Oh, you engineers and your laws," said her mother. "They work, Fever. What does it matter how? They draw the power they need from the environment somehow. Godsawk called it molecular clockwork, but even he could not discover how it was done. Yet the stalkers go on. Your friend Soland may still be stalking around long after you and I and the movement are forgotten." Fever stood with her and watched while Kit's chest was closed and a plate of armour fitted over the dead flesh. The red-robed mechanics then set to work upon his helmet, attaching a complicated sliding visor arrangement to the metal skull piece that now sheathed his head. They had just finished stenciling his new name on it when the body began to stir, making small restless movements with its feet and fingers. A green light flared up in its eyes. The mechanics drew back. "What is happening?" asked Fever. Wavy drew her carefully away from the creature. "It is quickening. The stalker brain is taking control of its new body. It is..." With a hard clang, sharp steel-blue blades extended from the stalker's hands. It began to thrash its arms about. Its mouth opened, and a terrible, deep, wordless cry came from it. One of the mechanics ran to a red locker on the wall and took out a clumsy-looking gun with a thick copper disc in place of a muzzle. He trained the weapon on the new stalker's head and looked up at Wavy, waiting for her order.
No, said Wavy. Avoiding the flailing blades, she went close to the stalker and laid her hand upon its chest.
Listen to me, she shouted, over the ceaseless scream. You are the stalker of the Lazarus Brigade. You are not yet operational. You will be quiet and lie still while you are made ready. Obey!
The stalker fell quiet. After a moment more, the blades slid back into its hands, and it lowered its arms.
Wavy Godshawk looked up at her assistants, and the one with the gun returned it to its locker.
That happens sometimes, she told Fever. A side effect of quickening. Some become violent and have to be destroyed with the magneto pistol. I'm glad that didn't happen to Master Solent.
But the thing on the bench was not Kit Solent anymore. It was a stalker of the Lazarus Brigade, and all it remembered as it lay there waiting for the mechanics to finish work was that it wanted to destroy the movement's enemies. It didn't even know its own name yet, the stenciled name which was drying white upon its brow. It had been given a bird name, like all that year's recruits to the Lazarus Brigade. It was called Grike.
Chapter 33. London Falling. There was a plan to hold the movement on the northern edge of the city. It wasn't much of a plan, but it was the best that anyone had been able to come up with in the circumstances, and Ted Swiney had decided it would have to do. He got the old clerks of council to toll Big Brian, the ancient bell that summoned all able-bodied men to defend the city. He sent criers out into the streets to jangle their handbells and holler, "Get up the barbican, you clouts!" But no citizen army presented itself in the square below Ted's balcony. Those men of the trained bands who had escaped when the moatway was breached had returned to London with no desire to face the movement again. They had stopped just long enough to gather their families and a few possessions, then fled south. As for Ted's own supporters, they had been disappointed that the riots had ended so soon, and were spoiling for another fight, but rumours soon spread among them of the movement's armoured land barges, their stalkers and their old tech guns.
"Is this all?"
demanded Ted, when he stalked out onto his balcony to review the troops. The only people in the square were those who'd had too much of his free booze to leave. He spat over the balcony rail and cursed. Spitting was banned now, of course, but what was the point of being mayor at all if you had to live by your own rules? Snatching up the telescope someone had nicked for him, he squinted through it at the tatty rooftops of the North Boroughs and the land beyond. What looked like a wall of mist billowing across the moonlit heath was really smoke and dust flung up by the movement's traction fortress as it rumbled toward London. He could see the lines of little lighted squares that were its open gun ports, and the lights of dozens of smaller vehicles spread out on either flank.
"Jesus! Who'd have thought the nomads would be so tooled up?"
Swiney had been brought up believing that Londoners were automatically superior to every other kind of people on the earth, and that they'd proved it once and for all by dishing the patch skins. He'd never dreamed this movement riffraff, this bunch of foreigners would have the nerve or nous to bust the moatway down. He went back inside and stomped through the barbican's big rooms in a haze of rage, issuing orders that no one paid any attention to, sometimes kicking things to ease his temper, which didn't work. At last there was a pummeling of feet up the stair carpets, and Mutt appeared with some of his lads, herding Dr. Crumb and the rest of the frightened order of engineers ahead of him.
"About time," snarled Swiney. "Who's in charge? Never mind, you can all come. Come on."
He led the way to the Chamber of Devices on the upper floor, where the clerks had told him London's most precious and destructive old tech weaponry was stored, ready for use in just such times as these. Worm Timber had been in charge of it, of course, and he'd taken the key with him when Godshawk's statue butted him 6 feet down. But Swiney had found a spare, and had already had a look into the secret arsenal. The stuff in there hadn't made a speck of sense to him, which was why he'd sent Mutt to drag the engineers out of the basement where they'd been penned. He kicked the door open again and stood aside so that Dr. Staling and his colleagues could file past him into the chamber. It was high, and lined with shelves, and some of the shelves had things on them, batteries and spools of wire and crated machinery from other eras.
"Well," he demanded impatiently, as the engineers looked about, "what do we use? What have we got that will stop that fortress thing?"
He snatched up a promising-looking artifact.
"What's this? A ray gun?"
"I think that's part of what the ancients called a Hoover," said Dr. Staling, taking it from him and flipping the switch on its handle, which made all the other engineers dive for cover.
"It doesn't work."
Ted grunted.
"What about those? Those silver balls there?"
Dr. Staling picked one up.
A ball bearing, he said. Quite a large one, though. I suppose it could be fired from a slingshot or some type of catapult.
Will it explode?
Of course not.
Then it's no blogging use to me, is it? Raged Ted. What else we got?
The engineers peeped into boxes and opened the lids of crates.
I don't understand it, said Dr. Collyhole, who had once been master of devices himself before Worm Timber ousted him. There used to be all sorts of things stored here, a kind of handheld cannon with the most ingenious sights, a big rockety kind of a thing, a very curious energy gun from the Electric Empire era.
The trained bands took that north, apparently, said Swiney. It blew up.
And there should be some paperboys, of course, said Dr. Wire,
opening the empty plan chest drawer where they'd been stored.
Ted understood. Worm Timber, he muttered. That greedy little goblin snitched the whole lot for himself. He's left us nothing.
Dr. Crumb raised a hand.
Could we not simply go to Worm Timber's establishment? He may not yet have sold on everything he stole.
It's on fire, innit? Said Ted, glancing poisonously at the engineers, as if he thought they were deliberately mocking him. Some of the lads got carried away, and off the bottom end of Cripplegate's gone up in flames.
He turned his wide back on them and stalked out of the chamber, pausing just outside the doorway to look back and shout,
Well, get thinking! When these clutes get here, I want something I can throw at them. I'm not going to be kicked out of my own town by a mob of foreigners.
Ted! Shouted Bricky Chapstick, appearing at a run from the far end of the long corridor. Ted, the nomads have stopped!
What? Where?
Just short of Finsbury.
Ted hurried toward the nearest window. The engineers went after him, joining other men, liveried servants of the fallen council and Ted's scruffy hangers-on, in a general rush. North of the city, the lights of the movement's fortress rose above the roofs of Finsbury like an unsightly new block of flats.
Bricky's right, someone said. It's stopped.
Ted grinned. They've seen sense, ain't they? They must have heard that things have changed and there's a real man running London now. They know we'll wipe the floor with them if they try it on.
He slung the window wide and shouted, Go on! Hop it! Leave it! It ain't worth it!
Everyone else watched the motionless fortress, waiting for its banks of guns to fire and send some colossal broadside slamming into the barbican.
This could be the last thing I ever see, thought Dr. Crumb. I may die here, without ever seeing Fever again, without ever even knowing if she is alive or dead.
But the fortress did not open fire, and in a few moments more there was something else to look at. A terrible, thin, rising screech drew everyone's eyes toward Bishopsgate, that long road which led down the slope of Ludgate Hill toward the North Boroughs. Sparks of reflected moonlight were being flung across the house fronts there, across the sails of a wind tram abandoned on Finsbury Viaduct. Swift shapes flicked across gaps between buildings.
Vehicles, said one of the engineers.
Seconds later, a dozen monos came bowling like bashed-off hubcaps into the littered square before the barbican. Charlie Shallow was not there to see the Northerners arrive. He had slunk off as night fell, making his lonely way by quiet streets back to Ketch Causeway and the Skinner's house. He hadn't a key for Bagman's place, but the Skinner had never needed to lock his door. Not only had the house not been burgled, there were little offerings of flowers and teddy bears all up the steps, and candles burning down in bottles, and little scrawly notes, which Charlie couldn't read, tied to the railings. Food, too. Pies and loaves and joints of meat, left as offerings to the Skinner's memory. Or gifts for his boy. Charlie stepped over it all, too tired to eat, too tired to care. He went into the house and fell down in his nest on the floor of the front room, and he was asleep before he even had time to think. It was late when he woke. Cold, bluish moonlight was creeping round the edges of the blinds. No coughing from Bagman's room, not this night, nor ever more again. He wondered why that made him so sad. He had only known the old man for about a day and a half, but it had been the only day and a half in Charlie's life when he'd felt as if somebody cared for him and thought he might amount to something. He lit a candle and went and found the eggs and stuff he'd brought for breakfast that morning. While they were cooking, he looked for clean clothes. His own were so stiff with mud and sweat that he doubted they could ever get clean. He went into the old man's room and found a cupboard and clothes inside it. There were good black breeches and a black long tunic that Bagman must have kept for wearing to the funerals of his fellow skinners.
The breeches fitted Charlie all right round the waist, as long as he belted them tight, and if he left them unbuckled, they hung so far down his skinny legs that it didn't matter when he couldn't find any stockings. He found a shirt, a bit yellowish round the neck, but clean enough. In a wooden box on the floor of the cupboard, he found a spare spring gun and a half-dozen bolts wrapped up in an oily rag. He cleaned the gun carefully, stuck it through his belt, and filled his pockets with the bolts. But when he went to put the tunic on, he saw that there was a little enamel badge on the lapel, the crossed knives of the Skinners' Guilds. "Who am I kidding?" thought Charlie. He took off the tunic and sat on the edge of Bagman's bed. He wasn't a Skinner. He wasn't fit to inherit the old man's gear, let alone his title. He'd let Bagman down.
"Finish it,"
Bagman had told him. But he'd bottled it when he had the chance to shoot the Crumb Girl, and now she'd escaped him, blown away in that flying thing. He shut his eyes, and Bagman Creech appeared as a cheap blue ghost, whispering,
"She's scriven, boy. It ain't like killing a human being. You do what's needful. It's all up to you now."
He sat there for a long time, feeling guilty and sorry for himself, until he heard a rising babble of voices outside. For a moment he was afraid that it was the people of the neighbourhood coming to ask him why he'd failed in his duty. But when he went and looked out the window, he saw the crowd in the street wasn't interested in the Skinner's house at all. They were hurrying past without even looking at it. He opened the window a crack, his own worries forgotten in his eagerness to hear what they were shouting.
"The nomads are here!"
he heard a man yell.
"They're at the Barbican!"
Chapter 34. Mayor versus Mayor. London had always loved a show. A bit of spectacle, something a little different, preferably the chance of violence. The arrival of the movement was almost better than a riot. Once they realised the city was not to be pulverised, people came out to line the pavements and peer down from balconies at the screeching monos as they went racketing toward the Barbican. Gangs of children ran behind, but not too close, because along beside the wheels came detachments of the Lazarus Brigade, big, battle-battered stalkers, moving at a clanking jog-trot with their finger-blades bared. Fever rode with her mother in the third mono from the front, the vehicle behind the Land Admirals. Looking out through the glass of the cabin windows as it bowled up Bishopsgate, she saw the watching faces of the Londoners lit up by its lights and shivered, wondering if some of them were the same people who had encircled Godshawk's head the day before, chanting for her blood. But they looked cowed now, even the roughest of them punch-drunk by the speed of the movement's arrival. And there was little chance that they would recognise her, in her red silk coat with its collar turned up and a fur hat pulled down to her eyebrows. In Barbican Square the monos halted. They lowered their parking props, which also served as ladders, and let out more stalkers, along with mortal warriors carrying big multi-barrelled muskets, or holding up the banner of the Wheeled Tower on skull-topped poles. The monopilots left all their lights burning, and the warriors lit flaming torches and held them high, so that the square and the broad frontage of the Barbican were lit up brightly. They stared about them, curious and ill at ease among these immobile buildings. Usually, when the movement took a static settlement, it was looted and then destroyed, and its population sent to man the slave mills. But Quirkus had different plans for this place. They'd been told to tread lightly. Two-man arquebus teams rested their guns on stands and swept them across the balconies and upper windows of the houses on the square, across the viaducts and rooftops. The stalkers stood poised, blades a-twitch, ready to rush in and slaughter any lurking Londoners who offered resistance. But no shots were fired. After a few moments, Quirkus himself emerged from his mono, fastening his cloak, and Wavy Godshawk took Fever's hand and said, "Come, dear, let's step down." The night air felt cool and fresh after the stuffiness of the mono cabin. Fever went down the ladder behind her mother, watching her gaze about at the city, wondering what she was feeling. Would any of these Londoners, looking on from their windows and the doorways of shops and houses, recognise Godshawk's daughter from all those years ago?
"What do you want?"
bawled a big, rough voice, echoing off the house fronts. Fever looked up at the balcony above the Barbican's prow and saw that it was not Gilpin Ween who stood there, but Ted Swiney. She stepped behind her mother, not wanting him to see her, but Swiney was not looking at her. His mean little eyes were fixed on Quirkus. Quirkus looked up at him.
"Do you have the authority to speak for London?"
he called.
"Speak for London?"
Swiney swelled like a cockney toad, flushed with pride and hatred.
"Speak for London? I am London!"
Quercus turned around slowly, taking in the watchers in the square.
"This city," he said loudly, "is now a possession of the movement. We have plans for it, great plans, which you may share in. Offer no resistance, and you have nothing to fear."
"That's a load of blog," shouted Ted Swaney,
as the echoes faded.
"I bet that's what the Dapplejacks said when they took over. We're Londoners, we are. We won't be ruled by some jumped-up gypsy like you."
He looked triumphantly at his people. He'd expected his words to raise a cheer, but apart from a half-hearted "Yeah!" from Mutt Gnarly, no one reacted at all. The truth was, most Londoners didn't much care who ruled them. The ones who had had their property burned or looted the day before were inclined to think that Quercus might be an improvement, and there were many important men who had, like Dr. Staling, already been swayed by movement agents. Meanwhile, the thugs and wastrels who had shoehorned Ted into the Barbican were too wary of the nomad's weaponry to show him much support. Quercus came up the steps in front of the Barbican, past the giant beer keg that still waited there, lofted up on its trestles. He stood directly below Ted and called loudly up at him.
"Your army is scattered, and your city lies under my guns," he said. "I'm not even asking you to surrender. It is over. I am Mayor of London now."
"Are you now?" said Ted, through his small, square, tight-clamped teeth.
He lacked most virtues, but he did have a fierce, stupid, cornered rat kind of courage. Hadn't he battled gladiators and Godshawk's death machines in Pickled Eel Circus? He was a fighter, and he wasn't going to give up the city he'd won to this pale little twig of a man. And wasn't that how they settled things, up in the nomad hunting grounds? You had to give them that. They didn't muck about with elections and speeches. If there was two nomads who both wanted power, they settled it like men.
"I'll fight you for it," he said. "You and me, right here, with all London as our witness. Winner takes the city."
Quercus scratched his nose.
"Hand to hand? Unarmed? No weapons?"
"A fair fight," said Ted proudly, grinning down at him, this little northerner he could snap with his bare hands.
The arquebus men fingered their firing levers. Several movement chieftains came hurrying forward to warn Quercus that he need not accept Ted's challenge, but he waved them away. He seemed amused.
"You're on," he said.
Down in the square, Londoners and nomads alike were drawn toward the Barbican, magnetized by the prospect of the duel. But Wavy Godshawk took her daughter by the hand and started to pull her in the opposite direction. She was carrying a bulky canvas satchel over one shoulder, and an electric lantern.
"Come now," she said. "We don't have time to watch this foolishness. The important thing is to make sure that Godshawk's vault is secured."
"But what about Quercus?" asked Fever. She looked back at the Barbican steps where the Land Admiral was stripping off his cloak and armour and handing his sword belt to a second.
"Aren't you worried about this fight?"
"Of course not. It will make no difference. The city is ours. It is just Quercus's silly pride that makes him want to indulge in this gesture. He's a fighting man, and this was all too easy for him. He wants it to feel like a real victory."
"But that's irrational. He might be killed," protested Fever.
Wavy shrugged. "It will make no difference. Another man can take his place and the movement will still have London."
"You're not worried for him, are you?"
Fever felt her ears turn pink and was glad that she was still wearing the hat.
"I would not wish him to be killed," she said.
Wavy squeezed her hand. "He is only a common human, Fever. Their kind are two a penny, you know. We are the ones who matter. You and me and Godshawk's legacy. Come, let's go and see if it's still intact." The edges of the square were filling fast with people as word of Swiney's challenge spread down Ludgate Hill. Wavy called out to some nearby stalkers to come with her and clear a way for her. Lammergeier, Corvus, and Grike.
"Do we have to have him with us?" asked Fever, still uneasy in the presence of the new stalker.
Despite his armour and his towering height, she could not stop thinking of him as Kit Solent.
"It would hardly be wise to go wandering about this town without a bodyguard," said Wavy. "Quercus agreed that I could take Corvus and Lammergeier, but he cannot spare many of his experienced warriors, so Grike will come too. Besides, who could be more appropriate?"
She shone the beam of her lantern ahead of them, and the crowd parted nervously to let them through. The Londoners' eyes were all upon the stalkers and not upon the woman and the girl who followed them. Fever watched Grike, trying to forget who he'd been the day before, trying to ignore her feelings of pity and disgust. She did not see Charlie Shallow standing in the crowd.
She did not see his gaze slip from the stalker's face to hers. A storm had blown through the Solent house. At least that's what it looked like. Blasted the front door in and roared right through, overturning furniture and wrenching down curtains, smashing the scent lanterns and spilling perfumes across the floors, filling the wrecked rooms with drifts of clashing scent. The stalker Grike strode through it all quite unmoved, following Corvus and Lammergeier. His visor was up and his bloodless face was the face of Kit Solent, but as his electric eyes slid over portraits of his wife and her father, his children and his former self, he gave no sign of recognizing anything. He has no memories at all, thought Fever. And me, I've far too many. There was no sign of Fern or Ruin as they walked toward the hidden basement and the passageway. Fever thought of calling out their names, but stopped herself. She would not want them to meet their father in his new form, not unwarned. Anyway, it seemed unlikely that they would have remained in this place, with its broken windows and torn-off doors. Even though she worked for the movement, Mistress Gloomstove surely wouldn't have left them alone to face the rioters, would she? They stopped before the bookcase. Wavy shone her lantern beam over it, and Fever reached up and pressed the stud to open it. As it slid aside, she half thought she heard another sound behind her. She turned, but saw nothing there. The house was probably full of small, meaningless noises as the wind whisked through it. She didn't notice Charlie Shallow dart behind the door jamb, but he was there all right. And he had watched the bookcase open, and he had seen how it was done. In Barbican Square, Quercus and Swiney circled each other, crouched and wary. Spectators pressed in on all sides. There was a silence that was not quite silence, rather the sound of a thousand people trying not to make a sound. Sometimes a burning torch flapped and roared as the breeze caught it. The short stood on tiptoe to peek over the shoulders of taller Londoners. Movement warriors lowered their guns and stood watching. Monopilots gazed from the open hatchways of their vehicles. Children were held aloft by their parents. "It'll be educational, this. When you're grown, you'll be able to say, 'I was there, on Ludgate Hill, the day Swiney did battle for the city against... what's this bloke's name again?"
"Quercus!"
shouted a warrior suddenly, and the others around him took up the chant, cheering on their leader.
"Quercus! Quercus!"
For a moment, it was only the invaders' voices that went echoing about the square. Then a Londoner called out,
"Swiney!"
The rest all looked at him with interest, waiting to see if the movement or their stalkers would punish him. When no harm came to him, others started to join in.
"Swiney! Come on, Ted! Swiney for London!"
Quercus lunged forward, feinting to the right, then driving his left fist hard at Swiney's head, but Swiney was ready for him. Caught him by the forearm and slung him past, swung his leg up in a kick that missed, because Quercus was tougher than he looked and recovered faster than Swiney had expected. His bony fist smashed into Ted's face once, twice, blood squirting sudden and red from Ted's nose. Ted staggering backward, shaking his head as if he was shaking off the pain.
"He's tapped Ted's ketchup," they said in the crowd. "He's hard, all right. It's a good thing we put Ted in instead of old Gilpin Ween. Gilpin Ween wouldn't have lasted 10 seconds against this geezer."
"Gilpin Ween wouldn't have asked him for a fight in the first place, you great soft blogger."
And the shouts going on all the time, booming off the walls all round the square, while pigeons scattered into the sky, and the two men grappled and went rolling in each other's arms down the Barbican steps.
Inside the Barbican, everyone had forgotten Dr. Crumb. He came out onto a high balcony and peered down into the square with the sort of concentration he usually reserved for petri dishes and bits of alum paper. Below him, Ted had gained the upper hand, but it was only for a moment. Quercus was as slippery as an elver, and the brisk blows he kept landing on Ted's ears and jaw were making the pubkeeper slow and stupid. There was blood on both men's faces now, blood spotting the steps and the cobbles of the square, and Ted had spat out a couple of teeth that he could ill afford to lose. But he kept fighting. He was glad, in a way, that the Northerner hadn't proved as fragile as he'd expected. This way all London could see the fight was fair, and when he won it they'd rise up and turf these nomads out and carry him shoulder high, the way the crowds at Pickled Eel used to when he laid out one of the Patchskins champions. But he knew that he was flagging. It was time to end this punch-up. Grabbing Quercus by his upper body, Swiney started manoeuvring him toward the trestles that supported that giant barrel of brimstone best. A few men had climbed up onto the trestles as the fight began, and anyone who wasn't in the know would have thought they were just up there for a better view. But one of them was Mutt Gnarly,
and another was Bricky Chapstick, and Ted had given secret orders to them both.
Chapter 35 Mementos. Fever was walking through memories, following her mother and the stalker Grike along the tunnel, with Corvus and Lammergeier marching behind her. It was so like the first time she'd walked there with Kit Solent, and so like other times when Godsawk had come this way, hurrying off to spend a few quiet hours in his workroom between meetings at the Barbican. The old man's memories were pouring into her mind, and the farther she went along that winding way, the more frequently she caught herself believing that she was Godsawk, and that the woman who strode ahead of her was her daughter. She remembered standing outside Nonsuch House, looking north to London, but instead of the real city she saw the future London that Godsawk had imagined. The Barbican was repaired. It had wheels and tracks again, as it had when it first brought the Scriven south, but it was 10 times larger than it had been then. Even Fever's own memories of the movement's traction fortress couldn't compete with it. In Godsawk's vision, the whole of London had been stripped and cannibalized to build 3 tall tiers of houses, parks, and manufactories on its back, and the thunder from its giant engines drummed across the brick marsh, startling up wildfowl from the reed beds as the whole structure began dragging itself laboriously across the earth on banks of huge wheels.
"A moving city," she said, stopping short. "He meant to move London. The thing in the vault, it's an engine, isn't it?"
She remembered the designs she had seen in the notebook at Kit Solent's place. She remembered drawing them now, just doodles they had been, the first inklings of an idea. An external combustion engine, based on an ancient device called a Stirling engine, but far more efficient. Wavy had stopped walking too. She stood with her lantern raised, her face turned back to look at Fever. Godsawk believed that with a few dozen such engines he could move London. He had time to build only one before the Skinners murdered him. Fever shook her head, clearing away the memories.
"But why would anyone want a moving city?"
Wavy laughed. "Perhaps it takes a nomad to see the beauty of it. Godsawk only envisaged moving London once. He meant it to carry the Scriven to the shores of the Middle Sea, where they would settle down again, far from angry Londoners and the spreading ice. Quercus has other plans. He means to make London the first true nomad city. He means it to keep on travelling the world, taking whatever it needs from other cities that haven't the means to get out of his path."
"That's not what I intended," said Fever, Godsawkishly. And then, more like herself, "That's irrational. It's deranged."
Her mother made a pretty dismissive movement with one long white hand in the lantern light. "I suppose it's a nomad thing. Who cares? By telling Quercus about Godsawk's plans and Godsawk's engines, I made him the instrument of my revenge. Thanks to him, London will be humbled. Its streets will be torn down to provide raw materials. Its people will be forced to toil at building Godsawk's dream. 1,000 years from now, the Scriven will be forgotten, but the world will still remember Auric Godsawk, the man who set a city moving." It seemed to Fever much more likely that it would be Quercus who got the credit, should the unlikely scheme succeed, but she did not say so, and Wavy, after smiling fiercely at her for a moment, turned and walked on. Fever and the stalkers went with her. And perhaps because she now knew each twist and dip of the way so well, or perhaps because she was so taken up with Godsawk's salvaged memories that she was not aware of much else, it seemed to Fever only a little time before the passage widened into the antechamber where the vault door waited. The stalker's green eyes swept the walls of the antechamber, and their beam came to rest on the other door, the door with the ivory handle which led to the upper world. It was open. And when Wavy went and opened it still wider, and looked up the long throat of the stairway, there was a dim hint of daylight high above which told them that the outer door was open too. Fever supposed that she and Kit had forgotten to shut them when they came back inside after Creech was shot. That had been less than 24 hours ago, but so much had happened since then that the memory felt more ancient than one of Godsawk's. Wavy returned to the vault door. She lifted her lantern again. Fever looked at the lock. For a moment she was afraid that all her misfortunes would have driven the number that opened it out of her head, but she just had to stop thinking for a second, and it was there. She closed her eyes and carefully pressed each key in turn, watching Auric Godsawk's old speckled fingers type out the sequence. 251-936-4085. The lock ticked. The door gave a little shiver, like something waking itself from sleep. Fever heard her mother make a soft sound deep in her throat,
almost a purr. Then the door slid swiftly up into the roof. Behind it was another, but that was already sliding to the right, and behind that was a third that went left. And behind that, darkness, and faint shifting shards of lantern light bouncing back from dusty metal surfaces. Wavy took out a pencil and a note tablet and carefully wrote down the code, while her stalkers dragged Kit's heavy toolbox halfway across the doorsill and left it there to stop the door from closing behind them. Wavy had loved her father, but she did not trust him, and Fever, knowing how the old man's mind had worked, knew that it would have been just like him to install some trap or trick that would slam the doors behind them and leave them both entombed. They picked up their lanterns and stepped across the threshold, cautious and curious as a pair of cats. Roaring with the rage of the fight, Ted slammed his fists and knees against Quercus's thinner, fitter body, driving him backward. Quercus fought back, landing a blow on Ted's right ear that jarred his skull and sent pain spiking through his head. He grabbed Quercus's hand, his shoulder, brought his head down like a hammer on the younger man's face. Quercus started to fall, but Ted grabbed him by his belt and hair and flung him bodily down in the shadow of the mighty keg.
"Swiney!" roared the crowd, the voice of London drowning out the shouts of the nomads.
Ted looked at him lying there, between the trestles that held the fat barrel up. The cobbles all round it were puddled with the beer that last night's revellers had spilled. The fumes alone were probably enough to set Quercus's head reeling. He would go to meet his gods stinking like a barroom rug. Ted lifted his swollen, bloodied head and nodded at Mutt and Bricky up on the trestles. And Mutt and Bricky, just as he'd told them to, kicked hard against the chocks they'd driven in between the trestle and the keg while everyone was watching the fight, and jumped clear. Except, like the stupid drunken clutes they were, they didn't do it quite at the same time, the way Ted had told them. Instead of coming down square and mashing Quercus like a cockroach, one end of the barrel smashed down before the other, missing him by inches. The nomad squirmed swiftly backward, shouting something furious and foreign at Ted. That was Ted's last sight of him. A half second later, the other end of the barrel came down, hiding him from sight. Beer spurted between the staves, but the hoops held it in shape, and the slight camber of the square set it rolling, and its own huge weight kept it coming, straight toward Ted.
"Oh, Jesus Christ," he said, not scared, just furious at the never-ending uselessness of Mutt and Bricky.
He eyed the barrel sullenly as it rumbled toward him, taller than three men, beer sloshing about inside, and the old anvil he'd added for flavouring going dunk, dunk, dunk in there somewhere like the clapper of a wooden bell. Ted waited till it was close before he stepped sideways out of its path, with that surprising prize-fighter's grace that he'd used in the old days to dodge charging stalkers and mounted gladiators. Only in the ring at Pickled Eel Circus, there had always been sawdust to stand on, not smooth cobbles slippery with spilled beer. His heel came down in a puddle of brimstone best and slid from under him. He fell heavily, and before he could rise, the barrel with its heavy planks and thick iron hoops was upon him. It looked, as it came down on him, rather like a huge wheel. There was a thick crunch and a sudden silence in the square. The barrel rolled on, drawing a long red stripe across the pavement until it came to a gentle stop against the water trough. Men were running forward to help Quercus to his feet. Mutt and Bricky and a few other London lads hurried to where Ted lay, but they'd have needed spatulas to get him off the cobbles. The barrel had ironed him as flat as a paper boy. The silence lasted just a heartbeat more. Then everyone was shouting again.
"Quercus! Quercus!" they chanted, as the battered nomad hobbled up the steps, turning at the top to raise both fists in victory.
And it wasn't just the men he'd brought with him who were cheering him, because say what you will about Londoners, they enjoyed a good fair fight, and they had always loved a winner.
Chapter 36. The Stalker's Question. A low, unwindowed room, ribbed with stone buttresses. Brass lamps shaped like lilies hanging from the roof. If you ignored the dust, the vault had the look of a place only lately abandoned. Piles of papers lay waiting to be filed on shelves. A cup stood on a desk, and when Fever peered into it, she saw the brown, crystallized dregs of Godsork's morning coffee. Tall figures stood in a rank along the farthest wall, and seemed to move when she lifted her lantern to look at them. Corvus, Lammergeier, and Grike all bared their claws, while Wavy instantly darted a hand into her bag, and brought it out clutching that clumsy gun, the magneto pistol from the Resurrectory.
but it was only shadows that had moved, thick, solid-seeming shadows that swung through the dusty air as the lanterns shifted. The stalkers that stood against the wall were old and lightless-eyed, and they wore veils and trains of dusty cobwebs